the choices that were made in the settlement opened the door for Alaska Native access to the polls in a way that we have not seen before.
A settlement in the Alaska Native voting rights case. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, September 10th. Good evening, I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, subsistence hunters near Kodiak ask for permission to target emperor geese.
Ben, you just want, if you had a dip net, you'd feel like you could just put it up there and grab a couple.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. The Alaska Marine Conservation Council reminds Alaskans to choose local, sustainably caught seafood when dining out or in. More information at akmarine.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Marine Conservation Council.
In a historic settlement, the state has agreed to provide increased language assistance to voters who speak Yupik and Gwich'in. The federal lawsuit was filed in 2013 by two Alaska Native voters and several tribal governments. The plaintiffs claimed the state doesn't do enough to serve voters who speak Alaska Native languages. Natalie Landreth with the Native American Rights Fund is an attorney for the plaintiffs.
The choices that were made in the settlement opened the door for Alaska Native access to the polls in a way that we have not seen before.
Landreth says the centerpiece of the settlement is translating the state's official election pamphlet into Gwich'in and up to six different dialects of Yupik. The pamphlet contains pre-election information on how to vote, biographical information on candidates, and ballot measures. The state agrees to provide outreach workers with standardized training and translations, which Landreth calls significant. The settlement also creates more partnerships with tribal governments, establishes Gwich'in and Yupik dialect glossaries of election terms, and calls for a full-time state elections employee in charge of language assistance activities. Originally called Toyokuk versus Treadwell, the case has been in negotiations for about 9 months. Lieutenant Governor Byron Malott inherited the case.
I am pleased to put the issues that were the basis of complaint behind us, reached an agreement going forward that I think strengthens Alaska's election procedures and processes.
Malott says it'll be difficult to implement, but he's confident incoming Division of Elections Director Josie Banky can handle it. In July, Malott requested former director Gail Fanumia resign. He says that decision was not a reflection on her past work.
But the obligations on the division and its director going forward to implement the settlement are going to be hugely significant, and it was on that basis that we felt new leadership would be required.
Banky, the outgoing city manager of Nome, is scheduled to begin in October. The settlement between the state and the plaintiffs was filed Tuesday in U.S. District Court. The state is expecting a final judgment on it in the next few weeks. And the settlement of the Native Vote lawsuit comes on the same day as news that Senator Lisa Murkowski has co-sponsored a bill reviving the Native reviving the Voting Rights Act. As APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, Murkowski is the first Republican to join more than 30 Democratic co-sponsors on an issue that has divided the two parties.
Lieutenant Governor Byron Malott told reporters he thanks Murkowski for supporting the Voting Rights Advancement Act pending in the U.S. Senate. Native American Rights Fund attorney Natalie Landreth thanked her too.
I think it's a lot of work by folks in the Native community to share information with her, and it's a recognition on her part that really, you know, access to the polls, it should not be a partisan issue. And it's unfortunate that in recent years it turned into one.
Democrats in Congress have been clamoring to restore the Voting Rights Act since 2013. That's when the U.S. Supreme Court struck down part of the 1965 Act. The law required several states to pre-clear any changes in voting procedures with the federal government due to their history of ballot box discrimination. Alaska was one of those states. But the Supreme Court said the formula that decided which states had to pre-clear reached too far back in history. So since 2013, a chunk of the Voting Rights Act no longer applied. The bill Murkowski is co-sponsoring sets up a new formula based on the past 25 years. Landreth says if the bill becomes law, Alaska would no longer be under a blanket preclearance requirement. But any state would have to get federal approval to change specific things about how voters access the polls. Landreth says the bill has a list of those triggers, and they're similar to key features of the settlement in the Alaska Native Voting Rights case.
When certain practices occur, no matter where they occur, they have to be pre-cleared, and that's the removal of, you know, the only polling place or removal of language materials.
Murkowski won re-election in a write-in in 2010, thanks in large part to the Native vote. The senator is up for re-election again next year. Landreth, though, says Murkowski isn't just acting out of self-interest.
I don't think so. I mean, I think that there are numerous senators with sizable Native populations, and they haven't jumped on in support of this.
It's unclear whether any other Senate Republicans will join Murkowski in supporting a restoration of the Voting Rights Act. Many see it as a law that gives too much power to the federal government. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell describes it as a relic of times gone by.
Obviously, it's an important bill that passed back in the 60s at a time when we had a very different America than we have today.
That's what he said in 2013, and McConnell said much the same last month on the 50th anniversary of the original Voting Rights Act. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Juneau group outfits kayaks for people with people with disabilities.
I can't sit in the sun and just, you know, sunbathe and so forth. I gotta do something just to be outside. I've always been like that.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley, providing marine petroleum distribution and energy support services throughout Alaska since 1953, supporting business development while helping safeguard the environment. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Subsistence hunters want to eat the foods traditional to Kodiak Island, and that includes one bird that's been off limits since 1987 due to low numbers, the emperor goose. The Kodiak region of the Alaska Migratory Bird Co-Management Council has put in a request to the statewide council for hunting access to the white-headed, gray-bodied bird. According to subsistence proposals, the Sunak tribe and the Kodiak Aleutians Regional Advisory Council are among two of the groups asking to harvest emperor geese for subsistence. One lifelong Kodiak resident, John Reft, has been both a commercial fisherman and a subsistence hunter, and remembers when he stopped seeing large flocks of geese. But he says he's seen more of them in the last 5 or so years around Women's Bay.
You'd be waiting for ducks to come by and there would be no ducks. And all of a sudden, here come flocks and flocks of these emperor geese. I mean, they'd fly so low and so many, 75 and 100 and a bunch. And then you just want to, if you had a dip net, you'd feel like you could just put it up there and grab a couple.
In fact, Ref says there's been an influx of emperor geese, and they're chasing away the ducks. Reft also says he hopes to gain subsistence access to the geese this year. The proposal will come before the Alaska Migratory Bird Co-Management Council at its fall meeting at the end of this month in Fairbanks. After being on life support for the past few funding cycles, the Denali Commission is full of muscle again, with an expanding mission to help rural Alaska. The commission, created by the late Senator Ted Stevens to fund village energy projects, saw yearly funding up to $150 million at its peak. Currently, the commission's budget is around $10 million, but a mandate from the White House to help combat the effects of climate change on remote communities may help it garner more federal dollars. Joel Niemeyer is the federal co-chair of the commission. He told APRN's Lori Townsend the commission will look to threats. Rather, the commission will look at threats to communities from erosion, permafrost melting, and flooding.
We want to understand what is the magnitude of risk, how communities are shall we say, their safety, community safety, members' safety are in peril, those sort of things. But we don't want to just go out and do a whole bunch of studies. There's been, this has been an issue that's been around for a long time. Many good people have worked on it. There's a lot of work that's already been done. We don't want to duplicate the work that's already been done. We want to pick it up and then apply those two other questions of what does flooding mean and what does permafrost degradation mean to this question of environmentally threatened communities.
We've heard for many years since Senator Ted Stevens was still alive and talking about there's no way I'm going to be able to get hundreds of millions of dollars to relocate villages. What do you see as the path forward for this work that, as you said, there are people that are being impacted right now today in communities? How will this be able to be dealt with in a way that doesn't cost hundreds of millions, but still can help people be on safe ground?
Well, many of the communities face adaptation strategies which will not cost hundreds of millions. They're not relocating. Communities that need to relocate, you are talking hundreds of millions. So I think it'd be very difficult in this financial environment to all of a sudden develop hundreds of millions of dollars to make it happen. So how can that happen? And I see two ways of making that happen. So let's get back to one of the efforts the Executive Steering Committee did. They identified 40 existing federal grant programs that can provide funding for relocation. So the question is, how do you marshal all 40 of them at one time so you can do one giant contract to get one general contractor to do all this major civil earth work to be able to do the move? That's very difficult to do. That's probably perhaps more difficult than actually doing the move, is trying to get the funding in place. So we actually have an opportunity to help gather all those funds and then assign them to someone else who would build it. So I believe that it's not about hundreds of millions of dollars that we need to come up with. There's a lot of money already out there. The question is, how do you get it all together at the same time from a myriad of different agencies so that you can do the construction at one time as opposed to piecemealing this out for 10 years?
Do you see this as this sort of this mandate from the White House? Is it directly in line with what the Denali Commission has been doing, or do you see this as a new direction for the commission? How are you seeing how this will come together within the work you've been doing?
Although this is effectively a new program for the commission, I don't see it any differently than most of the programs we've done before. For example, back in 2000, we developed a methodology to prioritize funding for rural community clinics. That then led to $300 million of funding through HRSA, Health Resources Services Administration, through the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and an equal amount of cost share match. So it was a $600 million program over about 10, 12 years. 122 state-of-the-art clinics were built. A number of rural hospitals and behavioral health centers and domestic violence shelters were improved through this effort. That endeavor started with a direction from Congress saying, we think you should look into this. We looked into it and developed a prioritization. Funding then came forward, and then we worked with program partners in delivery of the program. I can cite many of the other programs we have. It's a very similar process. So I don't see this as atypical of what we're doing. It's just something new that we haven't really done before.
Joel Niemeyer is federal co-chair of the Denali Commission. He spoke with APRN's Lori Townsend. A recently donated collection of letters, essays, photographs, and newspapers is shedding new light on the history of Alaska Natives' civil rights. One particularly controversial figure in the documents spent half a century advancing Alaska Native causes. He's the namesake of Sea Alaska's Heritage Institute New Archives. KTOO's Elizabeth Jenkins stopped by the William Paul Archives to learn more.
Here, look at this. Okay, A and B people and traditional leaders. Oh, I see my grandma over there.
SHI President Rosita Worrell stands over a table of photographs of ancestors in regalia, Alaska Native Brotherhood meetings, and less formal gatherings, relaxing around a table for dinner.
Cyrus Peck, Dr. Soboloff.
The collection spans from the 1940s all the way to the 70s and was donated by brothers Ray and Cy Peck. the sons of Cyrus Peck Sr., who published the newspaper Voice of the Brotherhood.
Remember, at this point in time, we don't have social media. We don't even have TV. So the newspaper print is really important in terms of educating people about what was going on, coalescing people into political action.
Some of the photos were taken by Ray Peck. He remembers his father giving him a Polaroid camera when he was a teen and asking him to take pictures of the Alaska Native Brotherhood.
I used the Polaroid because I could tell if something was good or bad, so I could always take another one right away.
He says at the time, he didn't know he was capturing history. He would paste the photos on freshly typed sheets from his dad's typewriter and run them off to the printer at the Juneau Empire. After his dad passed away, he found boxes full of old newspapers and letters and thought,
get them in a safe place instead of sitting in my house.
Peck turned over the boxes to the William Paul Archives in the Walter Sobeleff Building. He donated correspondence between his dad and Paul, who was an important but sometimes divisive leader in the Brotherhood.
He had progressive ideas, and he stepped on a lot of feet.
You might not know attorney William Paul by name, but you're probably familiar with some of the stuff he did, fighting for voting rights, and the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act.
He is the father of land claims. He was the one that really brought it, you know, to the forefront.
At Tlingit, Paul was the first Native elected to office when Alaska was a territory, and he was a leader in the Alaska Native Brotherhood. The organization formed in 1912 to combat segregation and racism. Paul was later instrumental in this. Worrell says she knew him. She says he was a mentor growing up, but recognizes he was also controversial.
Both within the Native community and the non-Native community. The non-Native community thought he was arrogant, brash, and pushy.
She even calls some of his political activity unethical. In the 1920s, a historian says Paul became powerful by helping Alaska Natives vote for exactly who he wanted them to vote for. He was also accused of taking campaign donations from salmon canneries, an industry whose unsustainable practices he vilified. Worrell says tactics like this may be part of the reason he's not more well-known. Still, he's an important figure.
Here you have an indigenous population taking the laws of the oppressor to protect themselves. I should begin. The storm has broken. Roy Paradovich is angry.
Worrell reads a letter to Cyrus Peck Sr. from Paul. It's about segregation in the schools, dated March 1st, 1949.
From there, we went on and considered the entire problem of Indian education and what we...
With the newly acquired materials, she hopes scholars and individuals can piece together a complex narrative of Alaska Native civil rights.
Because more often, when you read histories, you know, Native people are seen as passive recipients of Western culture. They aren't viewed as the active individuals in pursuing these rights. So with these documents, we're able to demonstrate that. We're able to portray history from our perspective.
Worrell encourages the public to donate items as they find them. Ray Peck says he might have a few more boxes to rummage through back home. In Juneau, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
These days, being into STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, doesn't make a girl a geek, it makes the world a better place. If you like numbers, nature, computers, and figuring out how the world really works, go to beanengineeralaska.com. You just might like what you learn. And it's not just for girls. This message on Alaska Public Media brought to you by ExxonMobil in Alaska.
Many restaurants around Alaska are on board with the public's demand for locally grown foods. But getting produce from farm to table quickly can pose a challenge for busy restaurant kitchens. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, that's where one entrepreneur spotted a business opportunity.
It's quiet during mid-afternoon at Spinard Roadhouse, an Anchorage restaurant popular with just about everyone. Chef Jacob Zellner has a moment away from kitchen duties to discuss what he'd like to do with tomatoes on specials he's planning.
That can be tricky. We use several different tomatoes. The ones that we're trying to feature, the heirloom tomatoes, we do 20 pounds in a couple days. For a special, that's pretty nice.
Spinard Roadhouse is one of the eateries that strives to use locally grown produce in its dishes. Bud Zellner says the kitchen can prepare about 1,000 dinners on a Saturday night, so finding time to go shopping at farmers markets is not easy. So who are you going to call when you need 20 pounds of heirloom tomatoes fast? Kyla Byers is the one woman behind Arctic Harvest Deliveries, a new concept in community-supported agriculture. One woman, one truck. That's what it takes to link Matanuska Valley produce growers to trendy restaurants in Anchorage. Byers picks up produce from 9 growers in the valley.
So they're selling to me wholesale, and I'm pretty much a distributor, just like any other distributor.
Then she makes same-day deliveries to more than a dozen Anchorage restaurants, selling the vegetables at retail prices. And what a delivery! Giant onions, bristling bunches of kale, string beans, and kohlrabi, tomatoes the size of your fist. Kitchen managers in trendy city eateries like the Bear Tooth and the Bridge snap them up. Byers runs deliveries 3 days a week and alerts the restaurant kitchens to what is available beforehand. Her business, started this year, seems to be unique. Byers completed an environmental and society program at UAA. She says she didn't necessarily want to farm, but wanted to stay in a related field. Distribution seemed to be the missing link between Valley Fields and city restaurants. Byers says the restaurants have been receptive to the idea.
They're excited, I think, to have another avenue of getting it besides the farmers market. It makes it a little more convenient for them, and they're able to put an order with me for a bunch of different stuff, and it comes from different farms. So they all seem to be pretty excited about it.
And Byers says her business supports local growers in a new way.
The farmers are, you know, very supportive of me, and they think that they like that, as opposed to some of the bigger distributors that are buying some of their stuff. I'm actually really promoting local instead of reacting to what my, you know, restaurants want. I'm saying this is all local and trying to actually promote what is available locally. So I think the farmers really can appreciate that.
With summer on the wane, leafy greens are in diminishing supply, but Byers says there's plenty of root crops that will last through winter.
So I think I'm going to try to do it through the winter, just, you know, maybe down to once or twice a week, and there'll be potatoes, carrots, cabbage, beets, maybe some other root crops.
The success of the delivery service has prompted Byers to start a CSA, that's Community Supported Agriculture, for consumer subscribers. There are 2 drop sites in Anchorage now with only 4 weeks left in the season. She's got a subscriber list growing now for next year. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
A spinal cord injury or amputation doesn't have to stop someone from being active on the water. A few Juneau instructors now have the know-how to modify kayaking equipment for people of all abilities after a training that wrapped up Tuesday. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
Yeah, that's not going to be a problem.
J.C. Terrell gets into a kayak that's sitting on a classroom floor. Orca volunteer Jared Spencer and an Above and Beyond Alaska employee are helping him get familiar with the kayak, how it works, and how it might be modified to accommodate his needs. Terrell's left leg was amputated about 10 years ago after he was diagnosed with cancer. He says he had a volleyball-sized tumor on his spinal cord.
It sucks, but you can't keep dwelling on it. You know, that's no fun.
Terrell is 44 years old and a stay-at-home dad.
I miss a lot of things, though, that I can't do, like snow skiing, working, construction. I loved it. You know, I worked in fab shops, oil companies, chemical companies. Didn't matter. Go out to the field. Got to travel. You know, it's not meant for everybody. You know, but I liked it.
Being a part of this adaptive kayaking workshop is Terrell's first experience with Orca, the recreation program of Southeast Alaska Independent Living. Orca staff contacted Terrell about being part of it and the opportunity to kayak.
As soon as they said that, I was thinking, yep, I'm going to take lightweight gear and go catch some trout.
With basic tools, the trainees have made a foam wedge, which they'll attach under the seat with duct tape. Without his left leg, Terrell is constantly keeping his weight on the right side of his body. Spencer says the wedge will make Terrell more comfortable.
So that when he sits in there, he's level. The seat's nice and comfortable for him and everything, but without it being shimmed, he's listing.
Spencer says they may also attach water jugs on the left side of the kayak for weight distribution.
So if we put 2 gallons of water over here and we tie it onto the side of the boat, then it compensates for the missing limb.
Modifying a kayak allows individuals of all ability levels to learn the same skills. Jeremy Oyen is an adaptive paddling educator for the American Canoe Association. He's leading the training.
When you're out on the water, if they do it really well, you can't tell that the boat's been outfitted. We've always said that the water's the ultimate equalizer because when everybody's out there paddling, we're all just paddlers. It doesn't matter if somebody uses a wheelchair or crutches or if they have a cognitive disability or anything like that. When they're out there and they're paddling and they're having fun, we're all just part of that paddling community.
Oyen finds the process inspiring. He says it can change lives.
It lets people get back to an activity that they thought that they couldn't do anymore, or just getting people out recreating and realizing that they can do this wonderful thing and go paddling in the ocean or the lake and see eagles and get back to that just being and just really enjoying the outdoors.
After sitting in the kayak and hearing about the modifications, Terrell says he's excited.
Yeah, this will work out. I didn't think so. I never thought of it. I didn't think I could be in a kayak.
Terrell says it'll give him something to do in the summer with his son or friends.
I can't sit in the sun and just, you know, sunbathe and so forth. I got to do something like fish. I don't even have to catch any fish to have fun, just to be outside. I've always been like that.
Later that day, Terrell tries out the modified kayak in a pool. He capsizes a few times, but remains undeterred. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Lisa Fu and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak, and Lori Townsend and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web editor, and I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. Alaska oil and gas have a huge impact on all of us, but how much do you really know about them? At akoilandgas.com, you can take an oil and gas IQ quiz and get the facts from reliable sources. This message sponsored by the Alaska Oil and Gas Association.
Broken hips and head injuries can have life-altering effects, especially for older adults. But no matter how old you are, it's important to be physically active to prevent injuries. Activity can also increase your strength, balance, and can be done at any age. Ask your healthcare provider about activities that will improve your health. Learn more about starting a new activity at injuryprevention.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.